I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Episode 66 of the Intercooler podcast is all about Ferrari. I was thinking about this, Andrew, given that you really love that mark, don't you? Particularly the racing side of the company. I think we've done one episode dedicated to Ferrari, but that's about it. Not many.
Yeah, and that was a while back, I think. Yeah. So this is obviously on the back of the launch of the 296 GTB, which was unveiled to the world last Thursday. Very interesting car. Lots to be said about that, and also I think we are going to have a bit of a sort of slight techno spod dive into V6 and V angles and V everything. And so I'm looking forward to it.
All that good stuff. Yeah, so we'll get underway with the 296 GTB, a new mid-engine supercar. Now, I know a lot of people will be thinking, another one. And it does seem as though out of Maranello, we're getting lots of new derivatives, lots of model updates endlessly. But this is actually a clean sheet, all new mid-engine supercar.
And is it? Is it,
well,
though?
Okay, go on. What do you propose? Apparently there's no F8 carryover, is that right?
They say there's no F8 carryover, but they say it's much closer related to the SF90. Which makes a lot of sense to me. I think that we journalists tend to think of these things as sort of fairly binary terms, that you have a platform and you spin cars off that, and then you have another. And in fact, particularly when you're in low volume, particularly when you're dealing with aluminium space frames designs, you can just evolve stuff, and you can evolve it to a point where it is unrelated to what it began as, and so you can say it's a new thing. So I think it is a bit of a red herring to say that it's based on the same platform as anything, really, but it's certainly much closer related to the SF90 than it is to the F8 Tributo, at least according to the Ferrari press conference, which I attended virtually on Thursday afternoon.
Good point. Yeah, a point worth making. I suppose we saw something similar with Aston Martin, didn't we? The old VH platform. It actually evolved quite a lot over time, but its origins were back in the original Vanquish, wasn't it? But anyway, we're talking about Ferrari. So let's run through some of the details of this new 296 GTB, because it is a very interesting car from a technological point of view. It's got a 3-litre V6 twin turbo. It's a very wide-angle V6. We'll come back to that. Also a hybrid. It's a plug-in hybrid. The power output is just absolutely astonishing to me. I remember, so we reported on it last week on Instagram and on the app, and when you sent through your copy, I just thought, well, that has to be a mistake, doesn't it? 819 brake horsepower.
From a three litre.
I mean, you wrote, didn't you, that Ferrari is clearly in no mood to bow out of the horsepower race. But actually, it seems to be growing exponentially, doesn't it? Power output seems to be rocketing.
I did look back at it a bit, and obviously that 818, 819 horsepower is with the hybrid added. But even without the hybrid, there is a 3-liter engine producing 654 horsepower, which is just nuts, isn't it? And I was looking back over Ferraris, and the only time I can see a similar gain from one generation to the next is when the 599 became the F12. And then I think it went from 620 to 740 horsepower from memory. So that's about the same because, you know, if you think that an F8 Tributo has, what, 710, and this has got 890. So it's about the same sort of leap. But yeah, they're not giving up, are they?
Yes, it's staggering. And people like us have been saying for so long, they're too powerful now. And they're getting more and more and more powerful. It's extraordinary. This one is rear-wheel drive only. So all that power through a pair of boots. 15-mile electric-only range, and it'll do 80-something miles an hour electric-only. I think that's pretty clever, actually. You wrote something recently on the app and on the Instagram site about downforce and road cars, effectively saying, don't buy into all those figures that are quoted, but I'm going to quote some to you anyway. 360 kilograms of downforce at 155 miles an hour with the Assetto Fiorano pack. Yeah. So that's a substantial amount, but it's not full hypercar territory, is it really, which is to be expected.
And at that speed, if you extrapolate backwards, that's probably not enough to require a spring rate that's going to ruin your ride.
That's the key thing, isn't it? They haven't ramped up the downforce so much that they have to give it all that support with solid springs. Okay, dry weight with lightweight options, 1,470 kilograms. So without the lightweight options at the curb, you're looking at 1,600 plus, which is sort of reasonable for a hybrid with a decent-sized battery.
It is for a hybrid. You see, you've already qualified it, haven't you?
Yeah.
Okay, so... What interests me is, so that's 40. So all these weights I'm going to talk about are, I call them cheat weights because they're not in a spec that anyone's ever going to drive a car. But, it's not just Ferrari who quote dry weights. Now McLaren do it too, and I think some others as well. So, it's all comparable. So an SF90 is 1570 dry with all the lightweight options, okay? Remove the front axle drive, make the V8 a V6 and call it a 296 GTB, and you save 100 kilos there, which is 100 kilograms. I mean, that's a lot of weight. But even so, despite having a V6 rather than a V8, the car is still, I'm just trying to remember now, 130 kilograms heavier than an F8 Tributo.
Yeah.
140. I think an F8 Tributo is 1330 dry. So, you're still adding 10%. And the other thing, the other little calculation I did was, take a McLaren 720S, which is quite an old car now, and put that into full lightweight trim, that comes in at under 1300 dry. Yeah, 1293, I think, compared to 1470 for the 296 GTB. Okay, now, if you look at the specs, you'll see that the McLaren has 710 horsepower and then the Ferrari has 819. So there seems to be really quite a distance apart. But the moment you actually produce a power-to-weight ratio, it's like this.
Yeah.
There's nothing between them. And what would you rather have? A lightweight car with a bit less power or a heavyweight car with quite a lot more power? And I think that you and I, and probably a lot of people listening to this, would go down one road. And I suspect that the sort of person who's going to be interested in telling people how much power their car's got, we'll go down another. So it's interesting, isn't it? You can't look at these things in isolation. It's not just how much power they've got, it's how much weight that power has to tow to. That's the only way that will give you a full, proper understanding of the way this car is likely to perform.
We can only speculate at the moment, but what do you think a 296 GTB engine would be like without the hybrid drive, given it's producing more than 200 horsepower per litre? It's so heavily turbocharged.
That's the thing, okay? That's where the hybrid is actually... I'm about to spring to the defence of the hybrid. Because you think to yourself, wow, I mean, how light would it be without all that stuff? And it would still have 654 horsepower in a much lighter car. That's just going to be a better car, isn't it? However, the reason the internal combustion engine can develop that kind of power is because you've got the hybrid filling all the gaps. Because otherwise, without... the hybrid torque to fill, if you're going to have a turbocharged engine producing 650 horsepower for 3 litres, it's going to be peaky. And this thing rests to 8,500 revs, which means it's going to be pretty unresponsive off boost. which would be horrible, except it's not, because you just get the hybrid to do that for you. And that's where it's clever. That's why you can get, that's why you can actually get these huge jumps in power, because what you're losing by doing it, you're putting back with the hybrid at the bottom end. So, you know, I have seen someone saying, oh, just get rid of the hybrid. It's not that simple, because the car would probably be horrible to drive.
That's right. Yeah, it's worth pointing out, isn't it?
Yeah.
All these dry weights, they do make me laugh. Lots of manufacturers do it now. And just as a rule of thumb, you and I tend to add about 100 kilograms. Actually, it might have to be a little bit more than that, maybe 120 kilograms or something.
That's 100 kilograms to get from dry to curb. But to get from dry and then with all the lightweight options fitted. So, you know, and they can be really, really lightweight. So, you know, it might be ceramic brakes. It might be, you know, carbon wheels. Yeah. There are all sorts of things, you know, carbon, bits of carbon bodywork. You know, you can take, I mean, I think the Assetto Fiorano pack on an SF90 is about 90 kilograms light. So, you know, that's like 200 kilograms there from dry to curb and from Assetto Fiorano to, you know, so, you know, if you've got the weight of an Assetto Fiorano SF90 with all lightweight options dry is probably 200 kilograms less than the weight of an SF90 just parked in a showroom with nothing on it.
Yeah, it is extraordinary. And manufacturers will keep on quoting figures this way. And all we can do is keep on highlighting what actually the real world curb weight is likely to be.
Yes, and as long as manufacturers are consistently unrealistic in the way that they quote their figures, the figures remain comparable. So, you know, that's kind of fine, isn't it?
Yeah, it is kind of fine. What cracks me up is when manufacturers quote a power to weight ratio using the dry figure. Because actually, a car with no fluids or fuel doesn't produce any power at all. It's says 0 horsepower per tonne, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, so a little bit more on the 296 GTB. Why 296? Have you got your head around that yet?
Yes, I've got it. Because they can't name it after an old Peugeot.
Yeah, so it should be 306.
It should be 306. And some people have said, oh, yes, that's because, like, you know, the 911 when it came out was a 901, then Peugeot forced them to make it a 911. Now, you know, in Ferrari nomenclature, that hasn't been the case, because obviously they had a 208 and a 308 in the past. But the point being was that the 208 and the 308 Ferraris came before the 208 and the 308 Peugeots. So they weren't naming it after a Peugeot. Ferrari 306. It just doesn't have the ring to it. So although the engine displaces 2992 cc, so it's absolutely close to 3 litres than 2.9, they have decided for the sake of naming. Also, there was a 296S race car.
So that it's, helps.
Whereas there's never been a 306 race car. So it's a much more Ferrari title. And given that, you know, everybody plays fast and loose with their naming things these days. You know, Mercedes with their 63s and their 43s and their 50 and everything else, you know, it's fine. It's fine. It doesn't trouble me at all.
Yeah, it's not really that important, is it?
No.
So there will be a 296 GTB Assetto Fiorano. It's just an upgrade package, really. But there's some quite cool stuff in there. You get Multimatic shock absorbers, presumably race style suspension. That's pretty cool. More aero kit. Alexan rear screen to save weight, a bit more carbon fibre. You can also have, there was something else. No, maybe there was. Oh, no, you can have those Cup 2R tyres that we've spoken about before, haven't we? And so when they quote a lap time around Fiorano that's the same as an F12 TDF and half a second faster than a Pista, I mean, that is staggeringly quick. A huge amount of that will be in those super sticky tyres. Okay, we reckon about £230,000 to buy, and very clear nod, isn't there, in terms of styling to the 250 LM?
Those rear haunches.
Rear haunches with the air intakes on top.
Yeah.
What do you think of the way the car looks generally?
I like it. I don't think people have said, oh, it's the best looking Ferrari since the 458. I think I'd go along with that, because I don't think it's as good looking as a 458. When I remember the 458 came out, I was just like, wow. Whereas with this one, I'm going, yeah, that's nice. But I'm not getting that sort of gut emotional response to it. I'm not looking at it and thinking, that is gorgeous. I'm looking at it and thinking, that's a really polished, well-executed job. They've done a nice job with that. So I think it looks good. But I'm not, you know, I'm not sort of getting that deep emotional reaction to it.
Ferrari did say, didn't they, when the Monzas were new, those screenless cars, the one and the two-seater versions, that that more classically beautiful, restrained, sort of curvaceous design would influence the forthcoming Ferrari production cars. And it has done. The Roma is true to that. The SF90 and now this 296, they're simpler, they're cleaner, they're purer. Compare it to an F8, which is very angular, very busy design. I think I prefer the way that they're going now, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't know. You mean, I mean, the F8 is obviously the ultimate evolution of the 458 design.
Right.
I think a lot of the original beauty of the 458 was lost with the 488 and then with the F8. And I think that you're now at a point where, although I don't prefer the 296 GTB to the 458, I think I do prefer it to the F8.
Yeah. Yeah, because they got so busy with, I mean, that car has been around for 12 years or something. And they got so busy with the design over the years, didn't they?
Yeah.
Okay, before we go any further, I just want to talk about the intercooler app briefly. And this is very on topic because just today as we're recording this, Peter Robinson has written an article for the app all about getting banned from Ferrari for life twice. We think he's the only person to hold that distinction. So it's just a fun story about what happens, or particularly back in the 70s, the 80s, and 90s, what happens as a journalist when you go to Fiorano to test a car and you give an honest opinion to your audience. Did Ferrari back then take it with good grace, good humour, or not? not is probably the answer there.
I think it is very much a sort of tale of its times, isn't it? And I think the other thing I would say, although Peter was banned for life twice, by the time he finally left living in Italy, where he had lived for, you know, he was on fantastically good terms with them, and him and Luca de Montezemolo. Peter is far too modest to say that they were good friends, but they were. So although, you know, not only was he banned for life twice, he was let back in twice as well. So it's just a great story. Peter's been a bit sort of reticent about telling it, because I don't think Peter is particularly the sort of person who likes sort of doing these sort of self-indulgent there I was type pieces. I love doing them. But Peter is, you know, he regards himself as a sort of industry reporter. But I'm just really, really pleased that we managed to persuade him to do it, because it's a really, really good read. And it provides a proper insight into the way that things, you know, used to be. With that particular bit of the motor industry, you know, way back when.
Yeah, that's right. Back then, it was the case that if you said something critical about their cars, the people at Ferrari would be hurt by that.
They
would take it as a personal insult. It's extraordinary.
Somebody did once say to me, and again, this was a long time ago, and nobody is anywhere near the company now, but somebody did once turn around to me and say, "Andrew, I thought we were friends."
Yeah. Wow, it's remarkable, isn't it? Different time. Okay, elsewhere on the app, over the last few days, I've driven the Aston Martin Vantage F1 edition. That's the safety car one. It's also the Vantage, I think, that the Vantage should have been all along. It's fantastic. Elsewhere, we've written about our first cars. So 9 or 10 of us wrote about our first cars. There's some good stories in there. Our engineer, Joanna Fidalgo, has been writing about the 90s. She reckons that was a golden era for the automobile, and she makes a good case. Andrew, you wrote a really cool piece about, it's effectively the typical maiden race weekend, and anyone who has raced will remember their first weekend and read that article and go, yep, did that. I remember that, because I think it's such an intimidating thing, isn't it?
It's a horrifying experience.
It is awful. And in that moment, when you're on the grid for the first time, you would do anything to be anywhere else.
Anywhere else, yeah.
And but yet, then the instant the lights go out, yeah, it's an extraordinary thing.
I mean, not that I wrote this, but I've always regarded it as a very interesting insight into the way that the human brain works. How you can, despite you knowing exactly what's going to happen, how your emotions can swing so totally. in such a short period of time, from absolute fear, dread and loathing to total euphoria, when nothing surprising has happened, when what has happened is exactly what you expected to happen all along. And yet suddenly, yeah, and you sort of wonder whether you kind of even know yourself, because the person that you feel you are 1 minute after the race has started doesn't recognise the person you were 2 minutes ago. The terrified, timid, cowardly person quaking in the car waiting for the lights to go, you know. And I've always been fascinated by that. And because although I've done, you know, I've done a number of hundreds of races now, I still get it a bit.
Yeah.
Never lined up on, sometimes if you're doing a long distance race and, you know, and it's the middle of the race and someone comes down the pit lane, you get in the car and off you go, that's fine. But there is something uniquely terrifying about the start of a motor race. When you're all there together and no one's moving and the revs are rising and you don't know what's going to happen and you're just hoping you get through the first corner in one piece. There is, it's certainly in everything that I do, there is, you know, there is nothing more, I suppose, focusing than that. And once it goes well, nothing more brilliant. But yeah, anyway, take a look. I enjoyed writing it, and hopefully if you have raced, it will resonate within you. And if you haven't, I don't know whether it will persuade you to go and race or not. It'll certainly push you one way or the other.
Yeah. It's a brilliant piece. Go and read it. So download the Intercooler app. Just search the Intercooler in whichever app store you use. You'll find it. Start your free trial. You've got a 1 month free trial, and see what you think. We think you'll like it. Okay, enough app stuff. Let's get back to Ferrari. Now, one of the interesting things is that Ferrari has made it quite clear, and it's intentionally moved to make it as clear as it can, that the 296 is not replacing the F8, the V8 range, which seems a slightly odd thing to say. So the F8 will carry on for a little while, apparently. We don't know how long for. What do you think is going on here? Are they fulfilling orders and they don't want the F8 to seem like an old car, or are they actually going to coexist?
Let's not forget, the F8 is the facelift of the facelift, isn't it? And Ferrari's never done that before. So my guess is that the F8 was created to fill the gap between what would have been the natural end of that line of car and the arrival of the hybrid. And I don't know, you know, Ferrari's adamant that it is entirely additional too. But then again, if you had a load of F8s you still needed to sell, that's what you would say, isn't it? So my guess is that the F8 in both Tributo and Spider form will be around for a bit. It's interesting, isn't it, that they haven't done a Pista. You know, it's the first of those cars, you know, from way back to the 360. You know, they've always done a special one, and they haven't with the F8. And I think I read a bit into that, into, you know, what its likely longevity is. So, and also, you know, if you just look at the way the world is going, you know, you're going to have a hybrid fairly shortly. So, you know, a year or two, I wouldn't back it beyond that. Could I just talk SF90 for a second? It is directly relevant to this conversation. When I drove the SF90, and however impressed I was by its power and its poise, and it is in very many ways an extremely impressive car, what I thought at the time, and indeed what I wrote at the time, was how much better it would be if it didn't have a driven front axle. So it was lighter and cheaper, and also had a boot which allowed you to actually go somewhere in it, because an SF90 just doesn't. And so now we have the 296 GTB, which is literally, which is that car. You know, it doesn't have a driven front axle. It is lighter. It does have a boot. You will be able to go places in it. And yet both cars will have a level of performance you can't use on a public road. And once you factor in the additional weight of the SF90, their power-to-weight ratios of the SF90 and the 296 GTB, they're still a distance apart. There's like 60, 70 horsepower apart. But, you know, they're not absolutely worlds apart. And you can buy a 296 GTB for, we think, £230,000, basic. I think an SF90 is £375,000. So what are you actually buying if you spend another £140,000, £150,000 on an SF90? You're buying a car which in the real world isn't going to be any quicker. But you're going to be buying a car which is heavier and which is far, far, far less usable, because you can't go on holiday in it. You can't go away in it. And I just wonder what that car's for now. I don't know. I mean, I haven't driven a 296 GTB, so, you know, I'm going to have to reserve judgment. But, you know, to me, if I was looking at, you know, oh, of course, okay, who's it for? It's for people who like telling people they drive a car with 1,000 horsepower. And if you want 1,000 horsepower, it's still cheap. You know, because, you know, if you want to find 1,000 horsepower, you've got to go, you know, you've got to go and buy something utterly ridiculous, costing millions. So, you know, for the sort of, you know, for the sort of the armchair enthusiasts and, the, you know, and the barroom jockeys who like, you know, who define the brilliance of their car by the amount of power its engine can provide, then I guess it has a point. But to anybody who actually is interested in driving and using their cars, you know, bear in mind, too, the SF90 is not a limited production car. So it's not a collector's car. It's not like a LaFerrari or something, which has a whole other reason for people wanting to buy it. I struggle. I really do. I'm not dissing the car because it does remarkable things. But, you know, just on paper, looking at the 296 GTB, I mean, I haven't seen a better reason for someone not to buy an SF90.
And save a lot of money. It's an interesting point. I suppose for decades, manufacturers like Ferrari, they had a very clear model hierarchy and they knew where each car sat and what each one was for. But nowadays, as horsepower figures because of hybrid drive, as they rocket, the hierarchies are becoming a bit jumbled up and certain models are treading on the toes of other ones. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out, but they do need to be very careful not to, you know, not to shoot themselves in the foot by giving their more affordable models too much power. Yeah, we'll see what happens there. Okay, so you've spoken about the SF90. We said we'd talk about the rest of Ferrari's model range and just sort of a bit of a state of the nation address on where its lineup is at the moment. So at the top, we've got the 812, and we know there's the new Competizione model coming. 812 is a sensational car. The drop-top GTS is the only one I've driven, but wow.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah, it's a great thing.
It's a great thing, and exactly what a V12 Ferrari should be. Elsewhere, we've got the Roma and the Portofino M. I've driven the Portofino M recently. You've driven the Roma.
Yeah.
I think you liked the coupe, didn't you?
I did. I really liked the Roma, yeah. I think it's a fantastically well-judged car. You know, this is Ferrari doing sensible, practical, yet still visceral and emotional. I mean, there are really few boxes that car doesn't tick because it's quiet and it's comfortable and it's a great GT, but it's also handles very well. It's beautifully balanced. It's got a great interior and it's stunning. I just love the look of the thing. I think the Roma is a fantastic looking car.
Agreed. Yeah, the Portofino M, I drove it recently and it's a big improvement, particularly over the Californias. It's so much better to drive than a California T as a sporting car. It's not the one I would choose. It's still pretty compromised by having... it's 100 kilograms heavier than the Roma, with which it shares a powertrain and a platform. And you feel it. It is there. Actually, what really struck me is particularly when you're stationary and you raise and lower the roof, as it comes down and drops onto the header rail, it lands with a thump and it rattles the car. And when it goes back into the boot, again, it lands with a thump and the whole car goes... And you think, crikey, that's a lot of weight moving around there. Even so, it's much better to drive than earlier versions
I haven't driven
series.
But I actually thought I was very pleasantly surprised by just the standard Portofino when I drove that.
Yeah, you can hoof it along a road and it's pretty good. It doesn't feel as compromised as earlier versions. So yeah, fine, great, and it serves a purpose, that car. So that's the model lineup as it is at the moment, but we know there's much more coming. Controversially, next year we'll see what we're currently calling the Purosang, which is Ferrari's first SUV.
Yeah.
That's a slightly troubling thought, isn't it?
I mean, there's that, and also we should mention also the electric car that's going to come after that.
Of course.
And what I'm trying to do now is get through these cars quite quickly because I'm trying to engineer in a bit of time to talk about V6 angles. I think the point with these cars are, you know, Ferrari is now a publicly owned company.
As of 2015.
As of 2015. or a lot of it is a publicly owned company. So they are now accountable to shareholders. Whereas in the past, they were accountable, well, to Fiat, to the Agnelli family, and to themselves, which meant they could do pretty much what they wanted. But now, you know, they have to provide shareholder value. And how do you provide shareholder value? You provide shareholder value by making more cars and selling them for more money. You become a more profitable business, and that's how you satisfy your shareholders. You know, what I find, you know, when I was growing up, and maybe actually even when you were born, and you know, there were three Ferraris. You know, there was Litlan. It was either a Dino or a 308. And then there was a luxury one, so it was a, you know, a 400 or a 456. And there was a fast one, which was a Testarossa or a 550 Maranello or whatever. And that was it. Three cars. Look at it now. And, you know, and I understand absolutely the reason for doing it, because it wouldn't be a very good public company if it didn't provide... It wouldn't be a very successful public company, you know, if it didn't provide value to its shareholders. And although the IPO did have quite a rocky start, you know, Ferrari has done extremely well on the back of this philosophy ever since. But it does make it a very different company. You know, it is not the company of Luca di Montezemolo anymore, which was very pure and very focused on producing cars that were absolutely the embodiment of what people thought the Ferrari brand should represent, which is not an SUV and it's not an electric car. But, you know, the world's a different place and Ferrari's a different company.
Yeah, that's right. Luca di Montezemolo was like the guardian of the old Ferrari values. Yeah. And now we're in a different age. That's right. It's a different world. It's a public company now. And it actually exists for a slightly different purpose. Okay, fine. But let's talk about V6s.
Yay!
Okay. Let's do it. If you're watching this on YouTube in particular, we'll do the hand gestures for you. So we'll do a narrow angle V6, we'll do a 90 degree V6, and a 120 degree V6, which is getting towards a flat, almost boxer engine. So we know the new 296 GTB has got a 120 degree V8, so very V6, excuse me, so a very wide open one.
Yeah.
And that's, it's an unusual configuration, but we're seeing it a bit more these days.
Well, in road cars, it's a pretty much an unheard of configuration. And then suddenly, three have turned up all at once. So the McLaren Artura, the new V6 in that, is a 120 degree V6. The Aston Martin V6 engine, which has now been canned, but was going to power pretty much everything going forward for them, that was a 120 degree V6. And now this new Ferrari engine is a 120 degree V6. So the question is why? Okay, so the 120 degree V6 has several advantages. Because opposing pistons can share the same crank pins, what you have is a very short, very stiff, very compact engine. It also can rev higher than a conventional 60 degree V6, and so you can get more power out of it. So why weren't they all like that? Well, the problem is most V6 engines in road cars have gone in the nose. And the problem is, once you have an engine that is that wide, it gets in the way of your suspension and it ruins your steering lock. So it only really works in a mid-engine car. Fine. But why hasn't it been in mid-engine cars? Because until now, mid-engine cars have been exotic things which have V8s and V10s and V12s in them. So there's been no place for these engines. But now, in the age of downsizing, where you have the need for a small engine, but it can still go behind you, it suddenly makes sense in a way that it never did, because, you know, not only is it shorter and stiffer and stronger and everything else and is able to develop more power, there's space between the V to put your turbos, which means you get that optimal hot V configuration, which means your turbos get going and is great for power and for emissions. It lowers the center of gravity too, because it's obviously a much lower engine. I mean, it's just a win-win-win all the way through. Which is why we are seeing them today. So my question to you is, how many other V6 configurations have there been?
That's a really Ferrari unfair question. Or generally, any manufacturer.
Okay, so what's the narrowest one you can think of?
Well, there are some that, they're so narrow, aren't they? They, like a VR6.
Yes, like exactly, the VR6. Yes.
And they basically share a head, don't they?
Yeah, they sit on the same head. So I think they were between like sort of 10 and 15 degrees. And of course, it still exists under the bonnet of a Bentley, which is, you know, the W12 Bentley engine is effectively two VR6s sitting on a common crank. Normal V6s are 60 degrees, but, well, we'll come back to the 65 degree V6 in a minute.
my God, we're going deep.
So, and then there are some weird ones. I assume you did a 75 degree V6. I think GM did a 54 degree V6. And the wonderful McLaren MP44, which had that incredible Honda V6 in it, which won 15 races at 16 attempts, had an 80 degree V6. But previous Ferrari V6s have had 65 degree V6s angles in them. And they did that because they wanted to get a bit more space between the V for bigger carburettors and that sort of thing. However, and this is what I want to talk about, the 120 degree V6 that Ferrari produces today is not their first 120 degree V6, because 60 years ago, they had just such an engine in the back of their Formula One car. And the reason for that is exactly the same reason it's in the back of the 296 GTB today, because Ferrari only went to a mid-engine design in 1961, whereas everybody else, all the Coopers and the Lotuses, had done it at the back end of the 50s. And it was only then, once they decided finally that they were going to put the engine behind the driver, that they could go to this optimum configuration. And they actually, in 1961... ran three cars with 120 degree V6s in them and one with 65 degrees. And the 120 degree cars were just faster and better. And they absolutely romped to the championship. I think they did seven rounds and they won all but two of them. And the only two they didn't win were at Monaco and the Nürburgring, which were handling circuits. And Stirling won both of them because he was Stirling. So that's the sort of history of the 120 degree V6 in Ferraris. It's great they're going to be doing another.
I've never driven a six-cylinder Ferrari, but then...
Oh, you should.
Not too many people have. So what are my options?
Dino.
Is it a Ferrari?
Yeah, of course it is. to call it anything other than a Ferrari is to indulge in sort of badge engineering. It's a Ferrari.
No, you're right. Fine.
There were Ferrari did do some straight sixes in racing cars. But in terms of V6s in road cars, there was the 206, which I think came out in 1967. And then there was the 246, which came out in 1969. And that's it. And it's a fantastic engine. It's a wonderful engine. It sounds like an angry V12. It sounds like a sort of rough and ready coarse V12. And it's all mechanical because it's got chain-driven camshafts and it is derived from the V6 engine, which Mike Hawthorn won the 1958 Formula One World Championship in. That was also a 65 degree V6. So it's a proper engine with, you know, proper heritage. It sounds wonderful. If you ever get a chance to go and have a quick run up the road in a decent Dino, do it. Mm.
Yeah, great. No, I will. So that's that. There you go. We told you we'd go deep on six-cylinder Ferraris.
Sorry. I've just been, you know, ever since Ferrari made this announcement last week, I've just been sort of living these engines. So I just felt the need to get it off my chest because I knew that you guys, if nobody else, would kind of indulge me and bear with me and say thank you.
It is interesting, isn't it, that based on the V angle, engines have different characteristics, different qualities. I find that stuff really interesting. Has anyone ever done a completely flat six?
Yes, Porsche.
But that is still a V, technically a V.
I did. Is the Porsche engine a boxer?
Yes. Well, they call it one, don't they?
It's appalling. I really should know the answer to this.
But because that's where Boxster came from, didn't it? Boxer, Roadster. It's a portmanteau of those two words.
But Ferrari called their flat 12 car a boxer, and that's definitely not a boxer. So just because you call it a boxer doesn't make it a boxer. That's appalling knowledge on my part. There'll be people who...
So there we go. If you do know the answer to that, has there ever been, what we're asking, has there ever been a 180 degree V6?
Well, how many other flat sixes have there been?
Subarus.
Tucker.
Right. I'll take your word for that.
The Tucker torpedo. Tucker's another whole great. Tucker's a great story. It's how, okay, Tucker was, there was a bloke called Tucker, funnily enough, who created this incredible car in America in the late 40s, early 50s. And basically the big three didn't like it. And so they just stuffed him. They absolutely stuffed him. There's a great film. I presume it's just called Tucker. I can't remember. It's got stars Jeff Bridges as this bloke. And it tells the whole story of what happened. Really, really. And it had a rear engine flat six in it. What about the Chevy Corvette? That had a flat six in it too, didn't it?
We're going to have to do a little bit of reading up on this, aren't we? And report back next week.
Yeah, a bit of flat sixery.
Yeah, good stuff. Right, okay, we'll leave that one there. Lots of Ferrari chat. We won't leave it so long next time. That was good. So there we go. We've already told you about the app over the last week or so. Just go and download it. Go and download it. Start your 1 month free trial and let us know what you think. We think you'll like it. And as ever, we'll be back to talk to you again next week.
Look forward to it. Thanks all.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.